Welcome back to another episode of Challenger City TO, where we explore how to revitalize Toronto as a brilliant place to live, work, and play. I'm your host, Ian Montgomery, and today we have a properly good guest. Joining me is Nick Badminton. He's a renowned futurist based in Toronto. He's traveled the globe, working across a variety of clients, industries, and even governments to help them envision new futures. In this episode, we delve into how a futurist might think differently about Toronto, exploring not just the wonderful utopia, but also the need to consider dystopian futures as part of our work. Nick shares his journey from the UK to Canada, his thoughts on the unique challenges and opportunities cities face today, and his vision for a more people-led approach to how we build our future cities, including Toronto. We also discuss the intricate dynamics of city planning, the importance of community-focused growth, and how Toronto can learn from global examples while carving out its unique path. So, whether you're a Toronto City Administrator, hi there, why talk to you, a local urbanist, or just curious about the future of our cities, this episode is packed with good stuff you'll want to hear. Enjoy. Nick, thank you for joining me on this. You're one of the guests I'm very excited to get into Challenger Cities with. But before we do that, I would love to let you give a little bit of introduction to yourself, some of your backgrounds, some of the work you do, because you do some really fascinating stuff.
Yeah, my name is Nick Badminton. I live in Toronto and obviously the conversations around Toronto, but I've sort of lived all over the world from the UK originally, traveled and worked from anywhere from the UK all the way out to Lithuania and all the way out to places like Singapore and Hong Kong. So I've sort of well traveled and been to many cities over the world. And what I do is I help companies look out 5, 10, 20 plus years so they can start exploring new spaces by looking at signals of change, identify trends of how the world is changing. So from an urban environment, from a city perspective, from an industry perspective, from a global geopolitics perspective as well, and really sort of trying to look at scenarios and stories about the dynamics of what's happening and the feelings of our future. So the work of Foresight and my work as a futurist is really to sort of supercharge strategic planning and really open people's minds to the possibilities and even unknown and positive and challenging futures that live ahead of us.
And like, you do that for all sorts of clients. Like, I think every single time we hang out and have a beer or a coffee, you're telling me about some weird and wonderful industry association, massive company, smaller company that you've done it around farming, you've done it around theme parks, you've done it around entertainment, you're doing it around airports.
Yeah.
So you look at the world in a really broad way, but then you also get to narrow down in really interesting spaces. I'd love to know how you then think about like doing that as your day job and then how you think about Toronto as this sort of challenger city concept.
Yeah, I'm really lucky that I can globally travel from my home base here in Toronto. And I actually now back on the road, I've done tons of flying just in the last sort of 18 months or so. So sort of seeing that world, but taking from so many different industries. And just in the last 6 months, I've chatted to like global governments and, you know, very powerful people, all the way through to brand marketing teams that are trying to work out the future of diapers for people as well. So it's everything in between. But what's really interesting is cities and urban environments to me are fascinating. And I've worked with a lot of municipalities and most of us live in places that are highly populous, complicated legacy systems that are accretive, things that have been built on top of things that have been built on top of things. So we've got this constant state of finding our limits and then potentially facing collapse and then finding a small way to transform how we do things, how to patch up what we have, but also how to completely demolish and rebuild parts of cities and rethink what they should be, but still on top of these old systems as well. So it's interesting that I sort of travel and come home and bring all these ideas of how we potentially thinking about some of the challenges and some of the opportunities that we face on a daily basis.
Before I actually met you in real life, I said something a bit snarky about Toronto on LinkedIn. And you kind of snapped back at me with like, no, you're totally wrong. You've got it so wrong. But like, you travel a lot. You've been to all these different places. When you come home to Toronto, like, what's your sort of view and vibe on the place as it stands?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm going to talk about this in a couple of aspects of living in Canada. I moved to Canada in 2008 and I moved to Vancouver. And why did I move there? It was the hiking, it was the mountains, it was the yoga, it was the beaches. It's a beautiful city. But it's kind of almost like an over-sterile city. Everything's been ripped down and rebuilt to be earthquake-proof and super safe. And tons of people that don't live in Vancouver own the property. And there's a lot of problem with the whole hedge city concept of investment property there as well. And as a city for years, it had so much for me. And it gave me this breadth and this space that I never had when I was living in and around London. But every time I traveled to Toronto, there was a real humanity to it, a real old school feel, almost like, you know, less nostalgia and more like something that felt comfortable and real and today. And things aren't uniform. And there's like 24 languages being spoken on the streets and you can get anything you want. Vancouver, with its, you know, a couple of dozen restaurant choices that you'd go to normally, is kind of replaced by the 1,000+ restaurants that you're too confused to work out where you want to go next, but you know you have to get through them all, right? But when I think about Toronto, you know, I live in a city that is under a massive amount of construction and transformation with a lot of talent and very much the center of Canada. And it's an exciting place. And someone called it recently to me, they said, Toronto is like New York City, but with a European heart. And I kind of love that.
I've heard it described as if the Swiss had been left to redesign Manhattan, you'd end up with Toronto. I don't know how true that is, or the people have been to Switzerland, but I kind of like the sentiment.
Yeah, you know, I have been to Switzerland. I kind of can see some of those parallels for sure.
So when you think of a challenger city, like to you, what would a challenger city be?
You know, it's really interesting. I mean, the addressing of the challenges of living together in harmony, working, traveling, getting from A to B. I mean, challenger cities almost need to challenge themselves to go against the trend of like cities built around cars and trucks and those having presidents, and cities built around businesses that sell things to people that live in those cities. Back to the challenger city idea of being more human, being more community focused, being nicer places to live, certainly post-pandemic, places where you can reduce the amount of time that you have to be on the road to have to go to an office. But also rethinking the food, energy, water systems, rethinking how we should even be considering entertainment and community and coming together in these places. It's really exciting. Every city that I've traveled to seems to have a big question about what comes next and how can we be better and different and sort of dialed up to 11 in those places. And we very much use an old reference and a template for what a new city should be like. Right. And I think that there's a challenger city of net new, right, which is somewhere like Songdo, South Korea, which is it feels very sterile, very antiseptic, but wildly functional, that fixes a lot of problems, but actually creates a problem of isolation of the people that live there. And then you've got somewhere like Toronto, which is the heart and soul is there. And how can you actually give it a platform to flourish as all of this change is actually happening?
It's really interesting, the new versus, I'd say that Toronto is new-ish still, and then you have like the old world of Europe. But there's the really interesting thing of like when you can do something completely net new, most totally new cities end up being really boring. You end up with like a Milton Keynes, and I've already had a dig at Milton Keynes, so I probably shouldn't.
Yeah, it's the same with Songdo, South Korea. Like I mentioned to you, I went down there for a United Nations conference, and it was like beautiful, templatized, beautiful big gardens and park, buildings around the edges, no bikes on the street, no people on the street. Everyone stayed in their high-rise towers and it didn't quite deliver on the promise, right?
Yeah, I feel like you have the old world, which is probably changing faster because it has to, because the constraint is there. And then you have this middle ground that Toronto ends up in where it's like, we're still really a city designed around the car. And people like to say, well, we're not Amsterdam, so we can't do bikes. And it's like, well, that's a lie. We can do bikes, but it probably takes a bit more serious thought because we haven't had the squeeze to change to be like quite as strong as some other places have had.
And politicians don't have the stomach to really weather the change and upset a lot of people along the way, right? I mean, I always look at cities like Barcelona as being old cities that have been able to take a new view on how it's operating. I think it was in 2008, you know, the world was sort of gripped with this global sort of financial crisis. And the new mayor of Barcelona put together, you know, I think 12 different task forces to look at how the city could save money, make money, improve itself and whatever. And out of that project came things like super blocks, which changed traffic flow and pedestrianization. to make tourism work a little better, to make living there work a little better. But they also looked at elements around smart car parking, smart water management, smart lighting management. They saved a ton of money. They created a ton of jobs. And they ultimately created somewhere that's new and vibrant, even though it's an old city as well.
So the thing I want to get into with is, like, when we talked before and you've written about this and you shared a lot about it and you speak about this, is like this idea of the dystopian future.
Yeah.
Because I think that dystopian future is something that sometimes we can be a bit scared of, or sometimes people, when they try and get too dystopian, can be a bit like they seem negative. And actually, that's often the best way to people to realize, visualize, have confidence with what the most to really create optimism.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote a book, Facing Our Futures, and what that did was add a holistic framework that really looked at positive futures and dystopian futures and, you know, obviously everything in between. And having that holistic view, it's been something that people have been pretty scared of doing. No one wants to look ahead 20 years and imagine a world that's terrible, but we have to, because we've kind of found ourselves in 2024 in a world where for the last 300 years, it's been based on water, energy, food, transportation, and greed and industrialization and going to work and jobs and spending money in retail. And all that. We kind of live in a dystopian world that's rather strange. It costs a lot of money and we're not quite getting exactly what we want. Cities don't work perfectly. I mean, I sort of was joking with you the other day that I saw one of the brand new streetcars, you know, stop, the driver hop out with a crowbar, change the gauge to go left, and then went left, right? And maybe some of these things have been fixed over time. But this is kind of a weird dystopia that we kind of live in, that we're sort of stuck with that foot in the past because of the collapse that's happening every single day. And we're sort of peering into potentially a brighter future. But there's this common element of humanity and how that's being served that's challenging and often draws us back into challenging places. Car crime, you know, homelessness. Businesses going bankrupt, people like losing their jobs, street parties, you know, having a fire in the corner when it was not supposed to happen, those kinds of things. So, you know, lots of little dystopias happen on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. It's when we get these big challenges, these big dystopias like a pandemic or like a financial crisis that we have to be really wary. But they're just elements that are dialed up in a very fragile ecosystem of living in a modern world.
I think every single business that had a consultant or a futurist roll through it round about 2019 had a post-it note on a wall that said global pandemic ? And then that post-it note, like, somebody wrote it down, somebody stuck it on the wall, but ultimately it fell on the floor or went in the bin. And very, very few organizations took it seriously, if any. The ones that did, or the ones that even gave it a half thought, were the ones that were the most resilient and prepared to go and do something about it.
You know, I think places like Asia that suffered a lot with SARS, Singapore, Hong Kong, you know, even China and the sites, like, I think they dialed it up to close the borders, you know, close everything, lock this down. Chatting to a really cool guy based in Wellington, New Zealand, and he said, we had a fantastic time in the pandemic. Not a lot of people really liked it at the end, and Jacinda Ardern still like quit and sort of a hailstorm of people not liking her, even though she sort of saved their bones a little bit during the pandemic. But everyone was kind of prepared and no one was willing to follow their plan as soon as the proverbial caca hit the fan, you know?
And I guess, like, you talked about Barcelona earlier. Like, I think it's interesting cities always hit this point where they've known they need to do something leading up to it, but it takes that political courage to do something genuinely different. I think Toronto is really close to that point. Like I've said this before, Toronto Canadians have this tendency to, like, we don't want to make a rash move. We don't want to go and do something too knee-jerk. We don't want to be like, do something big and brash. But at the same time, like, there comes a point where you got to do something, and Barcelona's had its moment to do that. I think New York's gone through that moment in the 70s and the 80s where the city really rebounded. I think Toronto's kind of there. I want to push the dystopian thing a bit with you, but, like, let's say we didn't do anything. Let's just say we just ignored the path that we're on and just kept going down it. Where do you think the city ends up? What is the dystopian future for Toronto?
I mean, I live in a part of the city just west of the center where, like, there's so much construction. Unchecked, it just becomes a city with a lot of existing low-rise buildings being destroyed, ultra-high-rise towers being built. There'll be half empty. that will basically promise to build great new neighborhoods and potentially great empty neighborhoods for a long time, because people aren't really acting the same way they used to like 4 or 5 years ago. So if it's unchecked, you eventually have like the brands come into Toronto. One thing about Toronto is if you go down the high streets or whatever, there's actually very few brands and lots of like, you know, mom and pop shops or like people with new businesses sort of out there and restaurants. And I think that if you leave it unchecked, it ends up being like much of America that we see, like lots of strip malls just connected to each other.
It's like the thing of we're seeing in the press more and more now that the huge condos we have, they're not selling, but we have a housing crisis, because that shows you we built the wrong things. Like there's only such a market for so many bank branches, Tim Hortons locations and one bedroom condos.
Yeah. And then when they put in Tim Hortons, they're not accessible because they're old buildings. And Tim Hortons didn't necessarily care enough to make the provisions that it needed to do in the new design, right? It's, people are becoming careless. And I think when you're somewhere like Toronto that's got so much pressure on it to grow, it's the fastest growing city in North America. More people move here every year than any other city in North America by a factor of 50%, right? I think it's like Toronto, Phoenix, and a couple of other cities behind that. And we're growing so incredibly quickly. People want to be here. People are excited to be here as well. But people are struggling to, you know, find places to live and work, even though, like you say, there are empty tower blocks everywhere, right? And people seem to be building the wrong kinds of things, right? I live in an area where it would be amazing to build a whole new park right next to like some museums and some new buildings. But instead, they're putting up like 30-story towers. Then 6 or 7 of them. And it's like, what are we trying to do? Just put people closer to rail links so they can go to the airport or go downtown. It just seems antithetical to building a good community.
There's a bit of the management by spreadsheet, but it's like, I put in 700 units in a tower. Great, job done. But like, it seems to miss the, and it's hard to put this in a spreadsheet or in a model, but it's that's 700 families or 700 couples, 700 individuals that have, like, they go to work, they shop, they hang out in the park, they sunbathe, whatever it might be. It seems to miss, there's a reason why you live. It's not just to have a roof over your head. And I think that, to me, that's the dystopia that Toronto is close to. It's then, how do we pull ourselves out of that?
We're like an algorithmic city. And it's like, you know, algorithm tells us that if there's empty piece of land, fit as many people as possible on that land. And part of that is historically because someone privately owns that land and like the economy has said, hey, you can sell this for like $1 zillion more than if you just sold it to the city to be used as a park, right? I went to see a developer who remained nameless, but there was a part of the city and it all got ripped down. It wasn't a great part of the city. It all got rebuilt. And this person was talking about the resiliency of the neighborhood, and the people there, and how amazing everyone was and how they were so passionately involved. I mean, they even wrote a musical about it, right? So like, if you do your research, you can find out who this is. But like, they wrote a musical about it. I sat there with my partner, and afterwards, it was the most vile piece of theater. The performers were amazing and diverse and from the community. And it was the Great White Hope saving a neighborhood by making $2 billion building infrastructure. That's kind of the algorithmic city that Toronto is. And it's a bit screwed up, right? So I think we really do need to come back to like what it means to actually build a person-focused city. But, you know, in Toronto, we've got huge deficits on budgets. Olivia Chow's come in and it's got a huge challenge. God knows what John Tory was doing before. You know, it's like that funny cartoon of like all of the tech systems are stacked and there's like a little pin in the corner, which is like one data center in Nebraska, just holding up everything at the end. Kind of feels like that's what Toronto is in a way, right? And we're on that constant state of like, oh my God, how's it going to sort of fail here and there? And how are we going to fix it?
There's an interesting thing of like when you go look for stock images of Toronto, they are 98% of the skyline from a drone or from the island or from a boat. And you look at that and you like, if you hadn't been here or spent time here or lived here, you would be like, oh my God, that is an amazing, like futuristic mecca of a city by a lake. This is utopia. But then they dig underneath it, and it's like to the point of, if you can afford all of that that you've built there, why can't you have proper trams? Why can't you have buses? Why can't you have enough houses? Why can't you have enough parks? The money's there. It's just the money's probably not in the right place. Like Olivia Chow literally said, the city's broke.
Yeah, I mean, this is what complexity looks like. We're a city that's growing. It's infinitely complex from the get-go. And it's just getting, you know, it's accretive. Things are being built on top of things, And it just gets more opaque and more complicated, both politically, structurally, administration. I get so many different bills for like water, sewage, waste. I think I get like 3 water bills or something like that. It's the most bizarre place. It's almost like, you know, what can we do to wipe the slate clean and take Toronto back to ground zero from an administration perspective so that we can focus it around people? And you almost have to dismantle the entire administration at municipal level, administration from a private business perspective, and all the way down to mom and pop shops to like every single neighborhood sort of holding itself together. And at that point, it's like, you know, too big to be able to untangle. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to pull threads and untangle them one at a time and hopefully find some magic in there in the future of Toronto, right?
I think it's really interesting. I care about Toronto as a cycling city because I think it's a really important piece of mobility. And we have the parking authority, like effectively owns the bike share. So yeah. The needs of one are not, one is going, how do we get more people to park downtown? And one of them's going, how do we make this place better for cycling? And you have like the cycling, the bike share's booming, but you kind of have the money from that sort of subsidizes parking. And that's where, again, like you pull one thread and hang on a minute, these two do not make any sense going together. If I get this harder, this thing's over here is going to fall apart. I want to use that as a sort of segue to, in your travels, what cities have you seen that have applied like great pieces of futurism to sort of change their trajectory?
It's really struggling. There's been a lot of people sort of from the outside looking in and thinking about what they could be. Like people have been thinking about the future of places like Lagos, Nigeria for a long time, but it's been sort of external folks projecting what it could be rather than actually having some impact on city design. I mean, I've worked with a number of different regions and cities to sort of highlight what's happening. So I've worked with York Region and everything from fire departments and the police to the administration of all of the cities in there to start looking about, you know, water, energy, food resiliency, and just getting it on their sort of agenda and on their horizon about things to consider, right? About creating resiliency around those sort of foundational systems. So I do see some cities doing that. Places like New York have been doing, you know, pockets of projects and really progressive sort of urban developments as well. You know, some controversial at Hudson Yards and some that are really interesting, like the High Line and the South Side. But it seems like there's no like overarching city strategy out there. A city comes out with a vision of 2050 or 2060 that goes far and beyond, you know, the construction of some new stuff. So I think that we do have to have more work that is actually at the city and the country level. Again, with complexity, you know, how do you really, you know, boil the ocean? You don't. You treat it one piece at a time. So the work that I do with my think tank and with my clients is very specific, and it'll be parts of a city or a function within a city. And I think that's okay. But again, you're just boiling a little piece of it and, you know, trying to consider the knock-on effects. It doesn't always quite do the job of reinvigorating what an entire city needs to be. What I have seen is cities are distracted often by big promises. So I worked with a city down in Ohio, and it was going to be a Hyperloop terminal. It was going to change the entire region. And as we know, for like dozens of years, Hyperloop's always been on the cards and it's never been delivered. And then the most recent iteration of that with Virgin and Elon Musk and whatever also hasn't been delivered. So, but cities wanted to believe that something was going to change so drastically, right? So I think, you know, people that do build cities need to be careful of these sort of glittering and shiny lures about, you know, smart cities. We're going to have smart cities. We're going to have these new ways of working, or, you know, light transit or fully pedestrianized zones, or all of that is sort of glitter in the pond of mud. And we have to be really very careful about how we consider what people actually want and how to make those changes as a whole.
I think it's really interesting that you touched on, you have the top-down state view of the world or city view of the world where you can try and plan the perfect thing. There's a great book on this called like Seeing Like a State, where it's like you try and project it down from the top, but you actually don't really understand all the grassroots things that hold it together. But then when you're doing it from the bottom, it's really hard to like keep going effectively where things from the top are slowing your progress. And really genuine change comes from both. It's like a neighborhood business improvement association that is sort of thinking, how do we spruce up the neighborhood, some planters and some bike lanes or some seats and things like that, make it a nicer place to go wander around and shop and linger and stuff like that. But at the same time, you have to have the vision that's just like, where is this city going? What do we want to be? What do we want to be known for? And I think that that's probably, to me, where Toronto no longer has the vision anymore. But there are brilliant pockets of the stuff underneath, but then sometimes it gets blocked.
And you know, there's a lot of these projects popping up from universities across Canada as well. So, and in some parts of federal government, it's like Canada in 2100, Canada in 2050, and what? And it's so myopic and so small and so based in new tech or whatever that it's sort of missing the point about really what it means to be a Canadian and a Canadian family, Canadian-owned business, or like, you know, Canada on the world stage as a global power and a trading partner. But then, yeah, you get to Toronto. We know who we are today, and we don't know who we're going to be tomorrow.
But this is a really interesting thing of like the Canadian, the brand Canada. I feel like we get lost into like, we either go hokey Canadian cliche, Tim Hortons, beavers, mountains, Mounties, niceness, hockey, etc. Or we then do like the new Canada, but the new Canada feels like, look at all these people from Asia that are moving here. Canada's really diverse, and it's all, I feel like those two things, like neither of them are wrong, but they totally miss what reality is actually like. And the real story is so much cooler than that. But Canada as a country and Toronto as a city don't tell that really, really well. And to me, like, that's where like, I'm amazed Toronto isn't trying to steal things from big Asian cities that have done like huge towers. And I'm also kind of amazed it's not trying to steal things from Europe where they've done sort of gentle density. That's the really exciting thing about being here, because people are from wherever, that you can create Canada's own version of that versus being like ersatz.
That's right. Yeah. Toronto is very Toronto. Somewhere like Vancouver, like, borrows its reference from a lot of other cities all across North America and Asia and the such. Like Calgary, it feels like Denver. Denver feels like Calgary. There's lots of these sort of like copycat cities and whatever. And yeah, it's like, I think because of the organic nature of how Toronto has been built, it just can't feel like that. It's like New York feels like that. It doesn't feel like anywhere else. Nor Paris feels like that. I mean, London feels like that as well, right? You know, you go somewhere like Zurich in Switzerland, it's very well laid out, but it's been very well laid out and everyone has fallen into line since day one, right? I think, you know, as Canadians, North Americans, we're a little bit more chaotic and we're welcoming the world. So once you get that culture clash, in a very positive sense, you end up with something that feels like 100 different things as soon as you wander down the street. And I think that that's part of the spice of what's happening in Toronto. It's great.
I think Paris is a great one to look at because there's an obstinance to a Parisian, like a born and bred Parisian, someone who's moved to Paris and become Parisian, a Parisian politician. See, like you kind of look at the transit they build and they've just gone, sod it, we're doing big things and we're spending a lot of money, we're going to build it. Or like the cycling culture, which is, we're not going to be Amsterdam, but Paris, we're going to make bikes part of Paris and we're going to do it our way. And I don't care how noisy or like the resistance is going to be, I'm going to do it anyway. And then you have a Parisian citizen who's like, well, I'm not going to go to that chain retail store or chain shop, I'm going to support my local thing. I feel like there's like that's a beautiful thing that it has.
It's true, but it's also, there's a huge class divide and a huge cultural divide in somewhere like Paris as well. You know, the people living in the projects on the outskirts of Paris are not having that beautiful experience, right?
Saint-Denis and the likes of it, that is not Paris.
well, this is it, right? But it is in many, many different aspects, right? But Mayor Hidalgo and what's happening, you know, banning cars downtown and bike lanes and the redesign, the walkable city, 15-minute city, the grants to local organizations. It's essential, but it's complex, right? She's chosen the battleground, which is the center of Paris. And then there's all of the other like challenging areas and beautiful areas of people from all over the world that are living, yeah, Saint-Denis, but like a lot of other places, Demasio, whatever, all the way around Paris, right?
I think for Toronto, that's the same thing. There'll be a certain type that's very noisy about getting downtown, But then you got like to think about the places that are further north in the city, like go past Eglinton, go past Finch, go past Shepherd, those kind of streets, and you're into a totally different world with totally different incomes, totally different infrastructure. You have to build for that too, and that gets lost.
Toronto's got pockets. So it's got pockets of communities, and those pockets are two or three streets that come together. And there's like hundreds of them sewn together in this tapestry. And that's probably one of the best descriptions of Toronto that I've been told. And it's just like you can literally move from like a small sector of the city to another small sector and get a completely different vibe. And I think that complexity, but the beauty of it as well.
I was thinking the other week, I went up to St. Clair and there's like three Vietnamese restaurants on like the same block. And it's sort of like, you can see there's this little hub of culture where three families have decided to open restaurants next to each other because it's like, oh, that's the best way we can bring people into the cuisine. I think that's kind of lovely. But I think like it's, you very quickly forget those places exist unless you actively go out and search them. And making it easier to connect those hubs up, I think, can make Toronto a way more vibrant city.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of hidden gems. I mean, I think Toronto's got more hidden gems than anything else in the city. When Michelin came here to like look at what restaurants deserved its coveted one star, two star, whatever, a ton of really small, very, very small, like high street restaurants ended up in the guide. And you were like amazed. They were, but like they absolutely needed to be recognized as being worthy of that. And it's cool that somewhere like Michelin Guide can come here and recognize that there is a little bit of magic in places that you didn't really think could it actually exist in the context of a modern city. And only like the well-funded or the trendy places can really make the cut, you know?
There's kind of cities that are really ugly. And like the some of the really great things are found in some sort of places that as a tourist you would never go to, places as a local you wouldn't necessarily make the effort to go to. I think Toronto must be in the top five cities for that. Of like St. Clair is not a pretty street and Scarborough is not a beautiful area, but like there's some absolute gems there, but like you really have to search for it.
Yeah. I mean, it takes me 15 minutes to walk out of like construction areas or industrial areas to get to somewhere great. But once you get to somewhere great, it's like world class, right?
Yeah.
But I think that's what cities on the edge really are. They haven't quite worked out how to do those transitions and to get there. And if you look around the world, I think New York's the same, London's the same, whatever. It takes a while to sort of step from one world into another. But that's the nature of megacities. And I kind of feel that that's the nature of megacities going forward.
Yeah. It's like New York's interesting. I feel that there's just a bit more mobility in the city, where if you want to go to Queens and there's amazing stuff in Queens, it's a bit easier to go get it. And like Toronto, like maybe we're proud of it being hidden. I don't know. I think that's where it's like, it's a little bit harder to go and get it. But like the cities where you can bring those sort of bridging, like you bridge communities, you bridge different groups who've moved here from elsewhere. You bridge people who live on the other side of the city. It makes it so much more resilient versus this sort of weirdly, well, I feel like what we have done is downtown is where you go to work for a bank and Scarborough is where you go for some great ethnic food and Bloor West Village is where you go to have a detached home and raise a family. I think that that's the thing, that if we can stitch those threads across those neighborhoods in better ways, we make a much more resilient city, and then you avoid the dystopia, right?
Yeah, 100% for sure.
So like, let's just say we gave you like free rein, Nick Babington, you're in charge of playing with the future of Toronto. Here's the pen, here's the paintbrush. Like if we let you loose on the city, what would you do?
If I could, I would actually stop building new high-rise residential. I would also cap on like building new industrial within the context of the city. I know we're growing. I know we need to work all of that out. I would actually dial up the amount of green space and the amount of community meeting spaces that there are. I mean, one of the greatest things about Toronto is, you know, they shut down a lot of these main artery streets like Dundas and Bloor and Danforth and whatever, and they let people loose on those streets. I mean, why aren't there more sort of green areas to be let loose on, right? It seems that there's a lot that needs to be worked out. And, you know, you can look at like what's happening out on the, you know, the eastern shores and what's happening in Toronto. And it's like more industry, more this, more that. And it's like economic growth, relentless economic growth should be replaced by relentless community cohesion.
I love that. You're going to get me into the growth conversation, but I think we sort of, our understanding of growth is, again, just more dollars. How do we make the most economic value from this piece of land? You miss the thing of that the person wants to go have somewhere to play with their kids and they'll turn up to work happier on a Monday and do their job better.
Yeah, do their job better, work a little harder, like come together, and don't mind doing all of that. And do you know what? That comes from a place that gives you space to breathe and move and have a good time with your family and friends, right? It doesn't come from like more high rises. Rant about high rises over.
I think it's an important rant to have. Like the whole point of doing this series is we can rant about a few things, have a purposeful idea of what to do about it. And then the goal is really go play. So what we want to get from the end of this is hopefully finding some money and finding some permission, some space to go play with a few ideas and prove there's a different way of doing things, right?
Yeah, taking back the streets, taking back the areas, giving it back to the families, giving it back to the communities, and giving people like power to actually have some say on the expression of what it means to be a Torontonian in Toronto and how all these cultures can come together and sort of coexist in a way that's more love and less sort of challenge and conflict and organized crime and such.
And we can trust you because when you're saying Toronto, you're saying Toronto. Whereas I've noticed when I do my introductions to these things, when I write Toronto, I say Toronto. When I'm talking about Toronto, I say Toronto. So at least you're like proving yourself like you've earned the right and the respect to be able to be like, these are the big things that I would do if I got put in charge.
Yeah, for sure. You know what? I came to Canada for the first time in 1997, and I've had a deep love and respect for all of it since that time. And I moved here, and I chose to completely recalibrate my life because it affected me so deeply. And really, it was the people, the places, and the fact that it was very different from where I grew up that sort of keeps me here, you know?
I think that's a really nice positive side to end on, really, because there's lots of things in the news right now about people leaving Toronto. Lots of people are coming here. And I think when people who are just moving here see these stories about people leaving, it can leave the voice in the back of your mind going, have I made the right decision? Have I done the right thing? So stories of like the people who've come here, made a life here, want to continue making this the best place where they can like live and grow their family. That's ultimately what we want.
I have a very active discussion in our household with my partner about this. And like she's from Windsor, Ontario. And every time we go there, it's like, look what we can have if we lived in Windsor, Ontario. But it's interesting just to create that positive tension of discussion that, sure, you get a big house on the water and you're close to some family. You can be in Detroit. You can fly at Detroit Airport. So all of that's taken care of. But you don't have like the 36 awesome joints just around the corner like you have in Toronto, like that can give you everything that you want with cool, interesting young people, old people, and everyone in between, right? She's like, imagine if you weren't living in Toronto, imagine everything that you lose. Then the truth is that you lose too much. And part of that is my identity these days. You know?
It's really interesting. I look at like second cities that back in the day didn't have all the brilliant culture and food and like places to hang out that like places like Toronto have been really fortunate to have. Some of those, like Windsor hasn't got it yet. No offense to people from Windsor. But there are second cities that are getting some of those things that make Toronto awesome. So it's like how Toronto stays awesome. But yeah, God forbid the if you end up having to move to Windsor, Nick, I'd worry for you then.
It's all good. That's why many people say that they're Detroitish or live in South Detroit, right? So,
well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this. There's loads of good stuff that's come out of it. So I'm excited to see what we can turn it into.
Yeah, cheers, Ian. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Challenger City TO. If you liked it, please do share. If you didn't, well, don't keep that negativity to yourself. Please do let me know why. We really want conversations that inspire positive change, so all that feedback makes this series better and better as we go on. And without further ado, we look forward to seeing you for another episode very soon. Thank you.